Welcome, Savannah, to Christie Walk, that is located on ceded Kaurna land. It's really interesting to meet you, and I'd love to hear a little bit of your story and what you've been doing recently. So would you like to introduce yourself and just give us a bit of a rundown?
Sure. And I'll just start with saying thank you so much for having me. I know that people don't have to say yes to having me visit, so I'm very grateful for everyone who has. So over the past three-ish months, I've been travelling overseas, so California, Oregon, and some places around Australia on a Churchill Fellowship focusing on communal living. And the scope is quite broad, so cooperatives, eco-villages, tiny home communities, co-housing, lots of different places, focusing on how people are living together sustainably from a social aspect.
So when you say from a social aspect, that social togetherness within the community, and does it link with broader communities generally?
Yes. So I think the first thing to say is the kind of driver for this is I live in London, or I have done for the past 5 or 6 years. I see a massive chasm of community. People know almost no one of a different generation. People don't know their neighbours, etc., etc., all the same stuff. But for a long time, I have been very interested in how we can live more communally in such individualistic societies, and how we can live together in ways beyond a nuclear family. I feel that often the nuclear family is seen as the only thing that's efficient, sufficient, whatever. And so I've been really interested in building community, togetherness, trust, belonging, living together in different ways, especially across generations, and bridging some of those manufactured divides. So yes, I'm interested in the social aspect, so how people live together, create that connection, mitigate conflict, these kind of things. And yes, interested in the broader community as well. So one thing that's come up a lot is I think that there is a stereotype where a lot of communities, intentional communities, for example, are perceived to be insular. But actually, what I've come across is that people in intentional communities are often extremely interested in how they build connection in the broader community as well. So I'm really interested in how these communal living environments connect with their broader community and benefit their broader community.
And what made you interested in this in the first place?
It's a big question, and I think there's a personal side and there's a professional side. Mm-hmm. The personal side, I think, as a queer person, I've always been really interested in living beyond a traditional nuclear family model. And I think, I mean, we know that there's more single family households than there's ever been. And I think this model of all trying to move towards home ownership, white picket fence, separation, individualism doesn't make sense on many different levels, socially, environmentally. And for a long time, I've been thinking, oh, there must be a better way. People are so lonely and separated. And then we come to the professional side. So for a while, I've been working on, I work for a non-profit, and we've been working on kind of various complex social issues. So things like malnutrition in aging, use of accident and emergency services, whatever it might be, lots of different issues. At the centre of almost every single issue I've ever worked on is loneliness, is lack of social connection. So professionally, for a long time, I've been thinking this is really about relationships and building relationships and building community. And so I started to do some work where I was living in East London on bridging generational divides and creating cross-generational friendships. And then I began to think, this is very situational. People kind of going out of their house to go to a coffee event or whatever with someone of a different age. But actually, how can we build community intergenerational relationships into people's lives? And then I started to look at different ways of living communally, got really, really interested in it, and yeah, applied for this fellowship, which I didn't think I'd get, and here I am.
That's amazing. It's so good that you've had the opportunity to research at a depth that probably doesn't happen very often.
It is a huge privilege. It's a huge privilege to take a break from a 9-to-5 to do something I'm really interested in. The people I've met have been incredible activists, people who are dreamers, but they're making those dreams a reality. It's been pretty incredible, and I'm loving it, and it's been very inspirational.
So you pull it all together, all of these places that you've visited and all the records that you've kept, and then you write it all up? Is that what happens?
Yes. So it's kind of three places where this is going. One is I have a blog, thinkitforward.net, and on that I'm writing as I go, kind of key sticking points, key insights, things that I find interesting. And then I'm developing a final output, which I'm hoping to be out around April. That will be lightweight, accessible. It's going to have, you know, photos and drawings, some case studies, different methods of communal living. It's not going to be a huge academic report. And then ongoing, I want to share my findings, stay in discussion, whether that be through, blogs, podcasts, whatever. So those are the kind of three roots, and it's not an academic piece of work. It's a 4-month overseas journey, but kind of I'm hoping this is just the surface, and I'm going to continue to dive in.
But it's a huge story,
yeah.
Isn't it? You know, what a wonderful opportunity to have the capacity to tell that huge story from so many angles.
It's huge, and like you say, there's so many angles, there's so many places I could dive into, and there's so many stories within the stories. Yeah. Every community, that's all these people are meeting, who have their own story of how they've got there, the challenges they've overcome, and there's no way that I'm going to be able to include everything, so that's why a huge part of it is just ongoing discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in our earlier chat, you mentioned that there are places that you visited that operate specifically for low income, or perhaps even social housing, but in an intentional capacity.
Mm.
Yeah, would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So my interests are quite broad. There's different elements. There's the intergenerational element, etc. But one interest is the affordability element, because community absolutely can't just be for people of a certain income bracket. And if you look at the US, for example, there's a huge growing co-housing movement, which is brilliant. However, a big proportion of it is for people of a higher income, and it's not that diverse. Having said that, I have been making a real focus to see what's out there which is affordable, and I've come across some really incredible innovations and models. So there's a lot that I will share in my final output, and a lot of examples that I will share, but just some that come to mind. So one is the Los Angeles Eco Village. It's a really incredible model. It's an urban eco village, and there's a real diversity. There's a diversity of five different areas, ethnicity, income. There's other areas, but a lot of people who live there are of a lower income bracket, and that's really intentional. And there's one other that has really stood out to me in this journey, called Canticle Farm, which is in Oakland in California. They have around 5 or so buildings, and different buildings are for different groups of people. So one building, there's refugees living there. One building, there's people who are First Nations people and whose ancestors would have been on the land. And there's one building which is the people living in it are black men who've been incarcerated, mostly in solitary confinement for many, many years. And it's all run by gift economy. So it's a really interesting model, and they survive through a lot of grants and people who work very, very hard to get grants. So, yeah, a lot of different affordability mechanisms. One place I visited is a tiny home village, which called Goodness, and it is for people who have chronic experience of homelessness. So again, it's that social housing element. So there's been a real range, and that will be a feature in my output, but not everywhere is social housing or super affordable.
No, in my experience, anything that is built to be sustainable is generally middle class.
So, yes, that is very common. And I guess the communities I visited, people are drawn for three different reasons, and there's usually a combination of at least two of them, and that's the ecological element, the social element, and then also the financial element. And a lot of the communities I have visited intentionally are a lot cheaper than alternatives. So there are the examples out there, and they do it in, you know, a real range of different, there's a real range of different methods. And I know that a lot of the communities that are, like you say, you know, upper middle class, are looking at how they can diversify and diversify how much things cost and build some sort of social housing into it. So it is a range, and examples are out there of affordability, communal living models, which are also ecologically sustainable.
It's the way of the future, isn't it? It's the way that... it surprises me that it hasn't taken off more than it has, because if you live in a place like Christie Walk, there's less cars, there's less pollution, there's more trees, there's more birds, there's more lizards, there's more of lots of things and less of lots of things, and they're all good for the planet and good for people. So why aren't there more of them?
Yeah, it's the way of the future, and it's also the way of the past, which is interesting. You know, a lot of people are looking for the kind of village style that we hear of. That seems, especially in urban environments, to be a utopian ideal of the past. And it is... So one of my key focuses is tackling loneliness and how these communities can do that. And people don't... This surprises a lot of people. But in terms of chronic loneliness... The age bracket that suffers the most from chronic loneliness is people aged 16 to 25. And most people think that it's older people. Mm. Older people do, that, you know, there is a huge problem of loneliness in older people. But yeah, the biggest number is in that younger age bracket. And so loneliness is a problem, a huge problem across all generations. And so just... what you said about, you know, it's a thing of the future, it absolutely is, and it's not something that's kind of just an alternative to a retirement village, and that's how some people think about it. And I think, yeah, that's really kind of one of the things that I'm focusing on and that I'm interested in, is we all need community, and we all have, people are rewarded for individualistic, competitive lifestyles. And it is completely unsustainable. And we are seeing outcomes across every single aspect of society that are really poor. And I think a big part of that is this individualism.
So you've just come from a community as well here in Adelaide that's a little bit unknown to most people. And what was it like being there?
So, is this the 8-person community in Adelaide Hills?
Yes.
Yeah. So, that was really, really interesting. So, most people there have been there since it was set up in the 70s. So, a long time. And that's very rare. Most communities I've been to, there's been a lot of new people coming in, a lot of people either passing away or moving on. And so, this community... I mean, there is a real depth of relationships there and a real commitment to the land and each other. And that is something I've noticed across the board is, I mean, it's very, very different to my experience of sharing flats in London, which is incredibly overpriced and often mouldy. But there's no pride in where people live. You know, you go to visit someone, you're kind of ushered in. here, when people live in community and they commit to where they're living, there's this pride and this care for the land and this understanding that the biodiversity of the land, the animals that are there, the neighbours outside of your community and the people within, it's all connected and people care. And that, you know, the place in Adelaide Hills was a really deep example of that because people have been there for so long. There's one person there who was born in that community and has had a child in that community. So that's wow. That three generations. And when I was there, I saw quite a few kids. They've built this new, really beautiful playground. Kids playing, this whole, all of these adults sat around watching, chatting. I went to community dinner, which they have weekly. It's what the Americans would call potluck. Everyone brings food. It was special.
Yeah. You've experienced so many different places. Are there any real standouts?
I would say Canticle Farm in Oakland, like I mentioned, is a big standout. I think one thing that was interesting is it's an urban farm, it's lots of things, but one thing it is a base for people to go off and do their own activism. And so there's so many different things going on and so many different focuses. And yet it seemed, from my short time there, really socially cohesive. And they come together, I think it was each morning, to do a community circle. And people really cared about each other. There's an interesting question that I've been asking myself as I've gone, which is, for the places that do seem to have a real social connection, what is it that binds people? And sometimes it's a shared vision, sometimes it's different things. But that was one place that did really stand out. And I would say another thing that stands out, this isn't a specific place, but across the two countries, different states, different approaches, different ways of working. Some communities have staff, some communities are self-governed. Across it all, there are some patterns. So in terms of standouts, a big one is Canticle Farm, which I mentioned before, when there's so many different people doing so many different types of activism, and yet it felt really socially cohesive. People come together. I think it's every morning to a morning circle. You really feel that people care about each other, which is pretty amazing considering people are there doing such a range of different things. In terms of standouts, I think one that I've mentioned already is Canticle Farm in Oakland. It was an urban farm, yes, but also a place where people do their own separate activism. And what was really impressive is how much social cohesion they seem to have, meeting, I think, every morning to do a circle. They have community dinners. They seemed really socially cohesive, which is incredibly impressive considering the diversity of background, the diversity of focus. People are doing so many different things. That was really impressive and beautiful to see and witness and feel. I think something else that stood out to me is, this isn't a specific place, but across the different countries, the different governance structures, the different way of doing things, the different people, there have been so many patterns of positive care, but also of challenges and conflict. Really similar causes of conflict have popped up. I've been to, I think this is my 52nd community, and I hear really similar things again and again. Which has been really, really interesting and I think affirming as well when I share it between people. Really similar things that cause conflict, really similar approaches, really similar stories of evolution and change when communities have been going a long time, and also really similar, beautiful, powerful stories of connection, especially in tough times, such as the pandemic or when people get sick and things like that. That can really bind communities together.
That's really very beautiful, isn't it?
Mm.
And it's one of the things that quite often doesn't get talked about, both the conflict and the closeness that that can develop.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, a huge amount of deep social fragmentation, political polarization, drastic economic inequality, generational segmentation. We know about all this stuff, and there's a lot of problems which are affecting the collective, and the response needs to be one of the collective.
Yeah.
And you really see that in these communities with this collective struggle, there's collective strength, and that's where you see yeah, the beauty and the power and the care. And it's really affirming and special to see these people living out values and community stepping up when it really matters.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about that, you know, that captures some of the time that you've spent doing all of this?
I would just say that I think reimagining how we live together is critical. And I think I wouldn't say there's a right or wrong in terms of anything. Different styles of community, different levels of social interaction and engagement work for different people. I've visited some places where people have come from deep trauma, fight or flight, chronic homelessness, and living in community and learning to trust one another. I've come from places where, you know, a group of upper middle class people have been sick of their individualist lifestyles and are deciding to do something different. Lots of different examples and different approaches, but across the board, reimagining how we live together is critical, and questioning the ingrained sentiment that kind of the nuclear family and not sharing and having as much as we can as an individual is the most kind of legitimate or fulfilling way of living. So, yeah, there's lots of different approaches, lots of things I've learned about what works, what doesn't, how people tick, what really matters to people, how different generations can just be so powerful when collaborating. But yeah, it's really powerful stuff. And one final thing I would say is I started this, I'm really interested in the intergenerational aspect, and I started this journey saying, asking people, you know, why is it so important? Kind of playing devil's advocate a bit, because obviously I care because this is why I'm doing this, but why is it so important that communities are intergenerational? Why is it so important that we connect across age groups? And I would say one of my biggest learnings is I flip that question now, which is, why do we have any communities that are segregated by age? It makes no sense. It's very dangerous when it comes to health, loneliness, all these things. But also, I mean, people have at different stages of life, they have different things they can give. They have different skills. They have different amounts of time. They have different needs. And this way of segregating people by aging and putting a group of people in a bracket and saying, these people have these needs, these people are interested in this stuff, it's just false and it's manufactured. And when people come together across this diversity of ages and diversity in lots of other ways, it's so powerful, it's so much more sustainable, and it's so much more fulfilling. And I've seen that, and I really believe that.
That's a beautiful place to end it, I think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. It was quite wonderful listening to you.